Welcome back to the Cattle Call. This is your host, Curtis Oldie. Hope you enjoy this second half of the interview with Jacqueline Wilson of Wilson Flying Diamond Ranch. Let's kind of transition here a little bit. We'll switch gears, and this may be the second half of this episode. Let's talk about some of the various enterprises, if you will, that you've been involved with, and that then we'll kind of tie that into Flying Diamond Beef and talk about it. But maybe you mentioned already about the embryo recips. Maybe talk about that a little bit and kind of how that worked and what didn't work.
Sure. So yeah, going back to about, let's see, that was about 2012. You know, I just got married. I got married in, 2011. And kind of looking for, you know, that was back when we were starting to have those succession discussions. And I was looking for ways to increase maybe find that niche market that I could increase my income. And so I had a friend of mine at the time that we were serving on the Nebraska Cattlemen Board Directors together. He said, "Hey, I think you'd be really good at a recip business." And I had no clue, you know, what he was talking about or what I was getting into. You know, I'd never been around embryos or flushing or any of that. And, you know, we had AI'd for years, for decades upon. They started AI, and I think back in the 1990s, you know, and so I was at least familiar with like sinking cows and everything, but you know, the embryo concept was new. And so we had just come out of a drought year. And so I knew we were probably going to have some fallout on in terms of opens just because of our breeding season so short, and had the opportunity. I think at that time I'd already had started a cow herd when I was 8, but you know, had an opportunity. I think I bought about 40 or so cows of my dad and my uncles and added them to my herd. And I thought, well, let's put some feelers out and see, you know, if we could get any takers on this venture. And I think I sent emails out to about 25 people that I knew, you know, in the purebred industry that, and within 48 hours, I was completely booked for that year. And so that just kind of took off. It grew beyond what I was expecting, you know, and definitely had expected it to. And then a couple of years later, you know, after I went through a divorce and everything and was able to, you know, maintain that cow herd and had an opportunity to lease a ranch. And with it, I had to buy a couple hundred head of his cows that he had. And so, along with stocking it with some of mine. So I was able to take most of my cow herd up there and do that, and was up there for a couple of years. We implanted for February and March calving, and then started to do some fall embryos. And there's a lot of, it's an interesting business. You know, looking back now, just because of the way that it ended, you know, with losing a business partner and a good friend and having to pulled my cows out of the lease and everything because it was droughted out. And I mean, there was so many things with how the business ended that I think the whole thing kind of left a sour taste in my mouth. But, you know, looking back to when it was going great, it was neat. You know, it was the customer service aspect, you know, and learning a whole other facet of the industry that I knew nothing about, you know, because it was a completely different mindset than I had been raised. You know, I've been raised with these, we're fitting these cattle to our environment. And, you know, when these cattle we're slowly developing, and here you get into that purebred seed stock and embryo world. And it's like, we want pounds on these animals and we want to push them and we want to, you know, to grow them. And it was this totally different mindset. So it made me really, I think it definitely made me a lot more well-rounded in understanding different segments of the industry for sure. But you know, it's something I get asked time and time again. You know, can you go back to that? Would you start another business up and do that? Because I mean, I've got people from all over the U.S. that'd be like, "Hey, we'll send you embryos, you know, if you want to." And I'm like, "Nope. I'm loving developing my ranch cows now for sure."
Yeah, no, that was my start in the Charolais breed. I started in '93. We had a really bad, we had the floods of '93 here, and grass got really washy. Most of my cows had a little bit of dairy influence in them, so they kind of sucked themselves down, and we ended up putting embryos in those the next year, and that was I'm kind of in the genetics, and I like the reproduction side, and I enjoyed doing that, and wish that if I could get the land again, that would probably be something I would probably go back and do instead of trying to play around with some purebred cows, but definitely something interesting.
Yeah, it is. And you know, after since getting out of the business, and I think one of the biggest lessons I learned for sure in it is you do learn a lot about customer service, and you do learn a lot about, you know, about the beef industry and some of the things, you know, that people were asking us to do, I still cringe at to this day, you know, and I'm really glad that I stuck with, you know, with my thoughts and philosophies on things, you know, and was not willing to do some of those. And so, but, you know, looking back now, it's opened a new market for us too. We sell a lot of open cows as recips and we sell them private treaty. A lot of them go back to Iowa. I actually just was on the phone night before last with a guy looking for another load of them, you know, and I think those, we can sell those at an increased value compared to what I can get for an open cow at the sale barn. And so, you know, it's really provided some other neat marketing opportunities for sure.
Yeah. Maybe kind of talk about that a little bit. What is it from the ET business that kind of got your name out there as having these maternal females, if you will, that have been a demand? Because, you know, I'll just, you know, I think Jordan Vandermolen, I believe he bought a couple loads of cows from you and maybe a few other people in Iowa. What do you kind of attribute that to?
Yes, it was funny. You mentioned I was actually just talking to Jordan the other night. So yeah, some of them, I think I look back because one of the, you know, we've done a couple different marketing things over the years. You know, that's one on the female side, you know, we sell open cows as recips. And then one of the other things that I've really focused on over the last decade plus is developing replacement quality females for other people. And what I mean by that is, you know, probably the last decade, I think I've sold at least 90 to 95% of all of our heifers that we do not keep as replacements go to somebody else to be developed as replacement females. And I think the reason why we're able to do that and why we have the repeat customer base that we do is because I'm probably pickier on what I sell somebody else as even opposed to what I keep for myself. And so what's been really great is, you know, I think we've done a decent job of building this reputation of, hey, we have heifers that are going to be available for sale. We feel they were developed right. You know, they weren't pushed. They're able to act like cattle are supposed to act. You know, the disposition on them has been really tuned in, you know, I mean, the health's on them been excellent. And then somebody, a customer will call and say, hey, can I get a trailer load of them or a pot load of them? And I think what's really important to me is I have those conversations that say, okay, what do you want? You know, what are specifically are you looking for? Are you looking for a moderate, easy fleshing animal? Are you looking for something that's going to have a little more growth? You know, And going off of what they say, you know, I hand select and hand sort those heifers to send that direction. But then I think the important part is I also send along all the data. You know, I've collected data from the day those animals were born. And so send that all along with them, you know, and I think that's one of the things that has kept people coming back is I like to tell the story of a couple of years ago. I have a great, great friend of mine. And Gene Dubas, he sells silencer chutes there in central Nebraska. And he's bought cattle from me for a couple of years now. And he wanted, I forget how many head he wanted, but he wanted a specific number of head. And I remember I sent him like two head less than what he wanted. And I said, Gene, I can't do it. I said, because with what you specifically want, I said, I can throw in another animal or two that might just be okay in that group, but they're not going to be that great group that, you know, you're purchasing. And he was just, I think he was a little blown away by the fact that, no, I don't care what you're paying for them. I'm not going to just throw two extra heifers in just to throw two extra heifers in. You know, I want you to get specifically exactly what you want. So yeah, it's been a great, you know, it's definitely added revenue for the ranch. It's been a little more work, of course, and, you know, a lot more customer service but I think it's building a great reputation of raising some great animals.
Yeah. No. And let's maybe talk about, I'm not sure how we would phrase this, maybe some industry partners, but you've done some projects with some of those. And I may be wrong on one or two of these, but if I remember right, you maybe did some projects with ABS, Neogen, and Allflex. Maybe talk about those projects.
Yeah. We've had some great partnerships throughout the years. We continue to get requests for even more. And we've done some deals with ADM was one. Just on some feed that we were using in the recip herd. Allflex, we were using some of their sense hub tags there in our recip herd, and we're doing some projects with them. Let's see, ABS, we were doing, I was putting in embryos for ABS at that time, and they were there for a couple of years. They were our main client. And then Neogen has been a really interesting partner on and off throughout the years. And we've done a number of projects with Neogen. We've done, of course, their iGenity beef. Our EnviroSmart label that we started this last Earth Day was kind of based on a Neogen principle in terms of what they were doing with their iGenity feeder. And done some other neat stuff with them, and along with partnering with some other unique companies. Like one of the projects that we did, it was a couple of years ago, we had a number of different partners involved, including a company out of Australia, a biometric company that's out of California, a blockchain company out of Wyoming. And we tokenized a group of feedlot steers to sell as NFTs, just as this project that they were looking for somebody to participate in. And so some of those partnerships have been a really, really neat venture. I think it's what's unique about those opportunities is it gives us a little bit different insight to what the industry part of agriculture, especially the beef industry, is kind of pushing and directing. And then at the same time, it allows us an opportunity to kind of push our cattle and see what they're able to do, in comparison to some of those others out there. And that's always it's always neat to see.
Yeah, no, those studies are pretty neat. And I'm kind of interested in that iGenity beef profile. I've used that on my individual cattle. And like I said, it's kind of neat to see that you're kind of on the cutting edge. And that's kind of take us into this next topic. You mentioned EnviroBeef, EnviroSmart Beef. Let's talk about your Flying Diamond beef program. When did you start in that, and what made you decide to take on another venture and get into retail?
Yeah, that was a real interesting. The FDB story is a really kind of, I think, unique story, because it was actually myself, my best friend, and the business partner that was in on the recip business that had passed away. The three of us started that together back in 2019. And myself and the business partner, her name was Jamie. We had talked about it for months, and kind of, she was also a nurse down in Colorado. And so she had a lot of people that she worked with, that were always looking to know where their beef come from. And we all know Colorado's are sometimes, they've got a little yuppie around Denver and whatnot. So, they're a little more focused on that than maybe other people were at that time. And so we decided, okay, let's go ahead and let's start marketing some of our product and to consumers. And so her and I started, and we were kind of in a little over our heads at first. And we're like, we really need that third individual in there to kind of be that liaison. Cause I had the production side figured out, and Jamie was excellent at marketing and advertising and the consumer relationship part, but we needed one more person. And so I got a hold of my best friend whose background was in packing plants and feedlot software, and said, "Hey, we need one more person in there. You want to get in?" And so the three of us started this business right before COVID hit. And so, here we had started it, and we were, talking to investors and working on finding a plant, and then COVID hit. And so all of a sudden, we were set up. We actually were set up really good, because when all the supply chain issues came about, we had already were a couple months ahead of where everything was going. And so we had product, and that was a great spot to be in. Unfortunately, it grew like, I think we did like 60 some head that first year, and it took off. And then it got to the point we got asked to do that NFT project. And then unfortunately, Jamie's passing kind of, that really, upset the apple cart, so to speak. And so we kind of put things on hold until we determined, you know, well, the estate was going to get involved and what they wanted to do. And so they decided they did not want to be involved in the business. And so then it was just Dan and I there for a while. And then over time, you know, she had a full-time job and I was ranching full-time. And we were harvesting cattle in West Cliff, Colorado, which for anybody knows, it's like a 16-hour drive for me to get down there and back. And we were storing product in Denver in a freezer storage. And I had a little bumper pull trailer, you know, that I was keeping product in here at the ranch, that it was about as temperamental as you could get. And I just decided, you know, what would be the best for the business. And so Dana got out of it about 2 years now. I think she's two years she's been out of it. And so as soon as she got out, I said, Dad, do you want to keep this going? And he goes, yeah. I said, you want to partner in on it? He goes, absolutely. So he partnered in, and within a month we had freezer storage here on the operation. We're able to get product here, and it's been really neat. From a financial perspective, does it make sense? You know, it's a break even. It really is. And I think that's one of the struggles I have time after time when I see these producers just going so crazy over this thought process that everybody needs to sell to the consumer directly. And, you know, and we need to close down these big packers and whatnot. And I'm like, if you put the numbers to it, it's really, really tight. And there's a lot of times it doesn't make sense. And so, you know, the one thing I think that it has done, and I will preach this time and time again, is it's made me a smarter producer. And from that reason alone, just knowing, you know, what product I'm getting back from the processor, what I'm able to share with the consumers, you know, it's changed some of the ways that I've raised and finished out our cattle. You know, I think it's continuing to make us ebb and flow, even though we have just a small, small percentage that goes to the DTC overall, it's really affected the overall business as a whole. And I think any time that we can bridge that gap between, you know, producers and consumers, it's a great thing. And so, I mean, it's amazing to me some of the questions that I'll get emailed on a weekly basis about the cattle industry, you know, from people that have never set foot on a ranch, but they figure they have finally found somebody who's trustworthy enough as a producer that they can ask, you know, what's honestly going on with mRNA vaccines with cattle, you know, or antibiotic use or growth promotants or, you know, or GMOs. I mean, it's crazy some of those questions that I get asked, that it's been a really, really neat experience for sure.
Yeah, I know. I think that's one of the things that, you know, it can be a little bit of a deterrent for some producers, because they're content selling their calves at weaning and not having to deal with them again and not have to deal with the general public. But in the position you're in, you kind of put yourself out there where they're wanting to know. They want to know where it's coming from and have those questions. And I'm assuming with that comes people who may take you up on a ranch tour or something like that. So it's putting yourself out there. And like I said, I think I would like to see more producers open to that. But I think most of us are content to probably just work in our own little area and not have to answer some of those tougher questions.
Well, and I think one of the things that really sometimes disappoints me as a producer is we have this mindset, I think, in the industry. Somebody said it. I had this great friend out of Colorado, and I've known her for years through NCBA and stuff. And she says, you know, the beef industry was one of those industries that sometimes we circle our wagons and we start shooting inwards. And, you know, and I completely agree with that. And I get frustrated, especially a lot of times dealing on social media, and you'll be reading producer comments, you know, about from people that, yeah, they might sell their calves once a year, you know, and which is great, which is fine. I mean, whatever program works for your operation, that's great. But then the day they sell their calves, they're done with them. But yet they can sit there and they can bash every feedlot and packer and grocery store operator and consumer out there, but they have no clue where those calves ended up. And, you know, that was something that was really, really important to me when I came back home from college in 2002, is I wanted to make sure that no matter if somebody else bought our cattle, that we still knew what those cattle were doing, where they were going, what issues they were having. And that was, that was big to me. And I remember at that time we were selling most everything through the sell barn, and we'd sell big load lots at a time. You know, I mean, we'd send out 5, 6, 8 pots at a time to the sell barn. And there was a couple of years in a row, this guy from Iowa had bought him. And I remember the first year I got up to the order buyer, who I knew really well, after he had bought him. And I said, "Where are those cattle going?" And he told me, and I go, "Could you give me his phone number by chance?" And he kind of looks at me a little funny. And I said, "No." He goes, "What for?" And I said, "Well, I'm just going to call him. My brother lives down that way. So if I get down there, I might run over and look at the cattle." And I remember it was there a couple months later, and I called this guy and I said, "Hey, you know, this is so-and-so, you bought our red steers here." And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "I'm in the area. Can I come in and look at them?" And he goes, "Yeah, sure." So we were riding around the feed truck the next day, and we get done, we're going down the alleyway, and I was asking him all these questions, you know, what's health been like? What's temperament been like? You know, have you had any issues at all? You know, are they developing okay? Blah, blah, blah. And he stops his feed truck at the end of the alley. He goes, "What are you doing here?" And I started laughing. And I said, "It's important." I said, "This is, you know, you bought these. I want to make sure that you knew exactly. I mean, I want to continue to learn from you to take it back and continue to improve our operation." And he goes, "Out of all the years I've bought cattle," he's like, "I've never had somebody that I bought cattle from show up on my operation." And I go, "Okay." And the next year he bought them, and he called me that year after he bought them. And he goes, "So when are you coming to see him?" I said, "It'll be a couple months, but I'll be there." And the next time I was down there, I spent the whole day down there, and we were in his fabricating shop looking at welding stuff. I mean, it was great. So I think, you know, somebody told me once that I was sitting in Brisbane, Australia, and I just toured a packing plant there. And the CEO of that entity that I had been with, been hosted by him for a week, him and I had been out to dinner, and he questioned me, and he goes, "Jacqueline, who's your customer?" And I said, "Well, the packing plant." And he goes, "No." He goes, "That's not your customer. That's my customer." And he goes, "Who's your customer?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And he goes, "It's the guy who buys your cattle." He goes, if you retain ownership, then yeah, it's a packing plant. But he goes, "If it's at a sell barn, it's a stocker, you know, it's a feedlot guy, or maybe a stocker guy or whomever." He goes, "That's your customer." And I kept thinking in the back of my mind, you know, I'd always been told we need to tell our story for the consumer because we want to send our product to the consumer. But then it started kind of make me think, well, we really just need to figure out where our cattle go in that next step in that life cycle too, and make sure that we're raising them correctly.
Yeah. No, I think sometimes we can be our own worst enemies when it comes to putting each other down. And when I see the post about, you know, home raised beef versus, you know, beef from or hamburger, when they show that package out of a grocery store or something like that. And it's like, at the end of the day, it's all the same. So
there's been nothing that's been probably more disappointing to me over the last couple of years with COVID than how producers that are doing direct to consumer sales, how some of them are marketing their product. You know, it's a lot of misinformation. It's a lot of consumer confusion. I constantly rip on this page, this social media page out of Texas, because one of the things that they are pushing is that they vowed to not do mRNA vaccines. Well, so what that does is it sends this message to consumers that everybody else out there producer-wise is using mRNA vaccines. And that's not true. USDA has no mRNA vaccines licensed for cattle use, for beef cattle use. And so it's like, quit spreading false messaging. Quit comparing your product to product in the grocery store to some other's project. Is there a place for grass-fed, grass-finished, grass-fed, grain-finished? And even those, I think just the wording of it can be so misleading is when those producers go hormone free. And I'm like, bull crap. Every cow out there has hormones. Every feedlot steer has hormones. You know, so you can say maybe no growth hormones, but at least use the right terminology. I mean, come on, don't confuse consumers.
Yeah. No, and I think a lot of consumers don't realize that. You know, especially cattle coming off an operation like yours, they're probably spending 75% or more of their life in a grass environment. And that's a whole nother story and things with some of the, I guess we'll, you know, the greenhouse stuff coming up, but, you know, it's, I think people just need to kind of open their eyes up and pay attention to what's going on around them.
They do. And I think at the same time, we need to make sure as producers that we're not confusing them. and making sure that at the end of the day, we're supporting the industry as a whole and not just out for ourselves in it. You know, we want to do the best we possibly can for the land and the livestock and you know, develop that amazing product that we can export all over the world that can become well known as U.S. beef. But it's, we've got to make sure we're sending the right message to consumers.
Yeah, let's kind of switch, maybe kind of transition into some of the things you talked about earlier. And one of those things is kind of some of the leadership roles you've been involved with. And in one of those, maybe you can kind of talk a little bit about, you know, maybe some of the struggles maybe of a woman being in some of those leadership roles. But one of the things I look at is some of the, I kind of compare you to some of the women we got here in Kansas when it comes to the Livestock Association. You know, at the top of my list is going to be Jan Lyons. She got dealt with a Christmas cow, you know, Debbie, her daughter. And then, you know, another one is Barb Downey. Maybe talk about maybe some of those struggles, but then also kind of some of the roles you've played through not only Nebraska as far as some of the trade missions, then we can kind of get on to dealing with the livestock associations.
Boy, I don't know. Those three names right there, that's too lofty company for me. I'm definitely not deserving to be in that same category as those three. They're all amazing individuals who I've got to know over the years. And you know, and I think that's one of the questions that I get asked a lot, you know, what was it like to be a female getting involved into the beef industry? And I mean, I will be honest, it was a struggle. I look back to many of the ways that I've got involved, whether it be on the state level or on the national level, and who was supportive and who was not supportive, and how you had to be so strategic about every single move that you made to get involved. Because in my case at that time, you know, I started getting involved especially on the state level. I mean, I was in my early 20s. I was a single female, you know, and it continued on. I mean, still, even to this day, you know, luckily now I feel like those years of being very strategic about making sure I was in the right place at the right time and had the right answer if I was asked, you know, I feel like they're paid off, and people realize like, I'm not a 5-second show pony. Like I'm here to stay in the industry. I love our industry. You know, I'm passionate about beef and I'm passionate about producers and consumers, but I want everyone in our industry to succeed. Well, there may be a couple of bad apples. I don't, but I mean, for the most part, you know, and I worked my way up through the Nebraska Cattlemen, got involved in NCBA kind of by a fluke deal. At that time they had what they called their Young Producer Council. And I remember I was out at my first NCBA. I was serving on Nebraska Cattlemen Board at that time. And I was on my first NCBA when I wasn't just in the South Devon Association booth at the trade show. And I stepped in this Young Producer Council meeting. And I remember they were, one of the things they were doing is they were electing young people to be, have a committee seat for each of the committees at that time. And they were going through the committee list, and there's people that were nominating, and then they were voting on them. And the resolutions committee had come up, and I was familiar with the resolutions committee with Nebraska Cattlemen. And it was just something that was right in my wheelhouse of kind of where my passion was in terms of, you know, of reading and writing and politics and lobbying and policy and all of that. And so I turned to the guy that was sitting next to me, who I did not know at that time. And I go, "Can you nominate me for that?" And he looks at me and he goes, "What's your name?" And I held out my name tag and he nominated me. And I remember getting up and getting this speech and about why I wanted to be on this resolutions committee. And I ended up getting elected onto that committee. And unbeknownst to me, because I wasn't very familiar with how NCBA worked at the time, and unbeknownst to me, you know, all the other committees, they had like 100 and some members on them, and the resolutions committee only had like 8. And so I remember going to my first resolutions committee member meeting, and I was sitting in there, and I'm like, I feel like I can make a difference here. And the next year, I got asked to serve as vice chair, moved up to chair. I've served twice as chair on that. I served on the board of directors on the policy division, you know, and then the last 2 years now I've served as chair of international trade, which is one of the 7 committees now for NCBA. And I think You know, along with that, I've actually this year I've got back on the Nebraska Cattlemen Board. I'm a Region 1 member services person, and it took a lot of thought to remember that, you know, we really need to be focused on our local producers too, and really be that liaison. And then over the year, of course, there's been other things that have been involved, but I think, you know, at the end of the day, I'm very blessed. I'm very blessed to have a partner in the business, which is my dad. You know, we're equal partners who he loves to work. I mean, you just can't slow that guy down. And he understands that how important it is to be able to give back to our industry and be able to guide and direct our industry. And if I didn't have his support, there'd be absolutely no way I could have do this. And not only that, but he doesn't want to do it. So he's like, yeah, you go for it. You know, if you want to be at the forefront of their operation and be pushing that agendas forward, you go for it. And at the same time, I think it's really given me the opportunity. I mean, what it's presented in terms of opportunities has been amazing. I just actually got word here a couple of weeks ago that I got a Newfield scholarship for 2024. So this year is going to be really different. I'm actually going to be spending 14 weeks this year traveling internationally, studying agriculture and animal welfare in the beef industry overseas, and doing a research project on that. And so same deal. I mean, he was the one when I was talking to him about it, saying, you know, I've wanted to apply for this for 25 years. What do you think about me applying? This is kind of like my last shot. And he's like, do it, you know, just do it. So the support has been amazing, but I feel like at the same time, like what I've been able to, hopefully there's been a thing or two that, you know, that I've been able to make the beef industry a little bit better.
Well, that was actually on my list here to talk about. And actually, again, I think I was coming back down I-29 a few weeks ago, listening to a podcast episode from Andy talking about the Newfield scholarship, which I found interesting later on that you applied for that and got it. Maybe talk about that a little bit, what that scholarship is about and what your plans are to how to use that.
Sure. So Newfield it's been in place now for about 70 some years, and it's an international program. There's multiple countries that have Newfield affiliates, and it was developed to provide agriculturalists, young agriculturalists, I think the age that they have is 25 to 45, the opportunity to develop a research project and to see agriculture on an international scene. So when I look back at what was those turning points in my life, you know, I think my first overseas international trip, I was 24 and I was a member of the Nebraska LEAD program, which was a 2-year agriculture leadership program. And our international trip went to Russia, Ukraine, and Poland. And that was the first time I really got to see agriculture internationally. And that was somebody could go, what was that peak experience in your life? You know, what was that emotional experience that you're just like, it doesn't get any better than this. That was probably that trip to me. And if I, everything that I've done since then, I can attribute to my involvement in that program and the influence that it had on me, just being able to see how the world is all interconnected. And it's this big picture that we sometimes forget. And so it opened up my love for international travel, but international travel that I could experience agriculture, especially the beef industry. And so, you know, since then, I mean, I've toured packing plants on 6 continents. You know, I've been in cattle operations on 6 continents. You know, I've spoke on multiple places, both in the US and overseas, you know, and just learning about agriculture in general has made me better producer, but at the same time, it's allowed me to share those stories with others. And I think that's just as rewarding. And so what Newfield does is the first, it starts here this March with their Contemporary Scholars Conference, which is in Brazil. And we spend a week down there meeting the other Newfield scholars. I think there's about 58 this year, international, I mean, worldwide, there's 5 from the US. And the neat part about Newfield is you just have to have some connection to agriculture, you know. So from some of the bios I've read, they've got everything from, you know, dairy farmers to urban ag developers to wine growers, you know, grape growers, to you name it. It's a really diverse group. And then you follow up after the Contemporary Scholar Conference. You have a 5-week, and this is a continuous 5-week, which was probably my biggest challenge with the ranch. I'm like, ooh, how is this going to work? But I got a great crew here that's super supportive and said, we'll handle it. And I said, okay. So my my Global Focus program is going to be in June and July, and it is going to New South Wales and Australia, India, Qatar, Ireland, and Mexico, and just studying agriculture in those countries with a small group. I think there's 11 in on that GFP. And then the remaining 7 weeks is focusing on our own individual research project. And my research project, so this last year, the ranch was named the 2023 Beef Quality Assurance Cow-Calf Producer of the Year. And I think there's like 900,000 cow-calf producers in the U.S. So it was something, it was probably one of the most humbling things that Dad and I have had happen for us. But the Beef Quality Assurance Program, in my travels, I've found out that there's a lot of countries out there that don't have that similar education and training opportunities for producers. I've found out a lot about it this summer when I spent some time in the Caribbean, both in the Bahamas and Jamaica, speaking to producers down there. And they're like, yeah, we have nothing like that. And so my research project is focused on beef animal welfare and handling and in other countries, and the potential of developing an international program, you know, that people can use as a template that's similar along the lines of BQA, but that we can use on an international level to hopefully help really, really develop some of those same standards in other countries that we see here in the U.S. in terms of how we raise our beef cattle. But yeah, it's an exciting, I'm so excited about it. I'm just ecstatic to get involved in it, you know, and I think it was the perfect time. Like I told everyone, this is the only time I was going to apply. This was my one shot. If I didn't get it, I wasn't going to do it again, because everything was just lining up for it to be this year.
Yeah. Well, the next question I've got is why. We've spent probably a little over an hour, 20 minutes here, maybe talking about all the things that you got going on. Why is it important for you to be part of things like Newfield, various trade missions there for the state of Nebraska, Nebraska Cattlemen's, the NCBA? Why is it important to, and maybe this is more, you know, one of the things, I don't know if I told you, I got a foundation with mental health, and then we're also going to do a mentorship portion of that as well. And maybe this is kind of maybe reaching out to some of those younger producers. Why is it important to be involved in these different entities?
Yeah, you know, there's this could be a whole other podcast in general of why it's so important to get involved. But for me, there's a lot of personal things in it. You know, my parents, they really raised both my brother and I with this sense of servant leadership. You know, really, they raised us in this mindset that yes, we can grow in business and we can develop the ranch and blah blah blah. But you want to be giving back to the community. Over the years, that community picture has grown. You know, from maybe being involved at the church or the extension board or the 4-H council, and it's grown. You know, to now like speaking overseas and talking to producers, you know, in other countries. And so I think that servant leadership part, that's kind of been the basis of it, but it goes a little bit further than that. And I think it's because when I was growing up, especially after college and stuff, I realized, you know, ranching was not my first choice. I actually, when I was in college, I wanted to go to law school and be a lobbyist. And then I was asked to come home for that summer, my senior year of college, and I've never been back, you know, and it took me a couple of years to realize that, yeah, ranching is what I wanted to do for my entire life. And so being able to show that, you know, we're not the stereotype that I think so many urbanites have of us, where they have, you know, farmer Fred and Joan Pitchfork out there with a piece of wheat seed in their teeth, you know, and they're hanging on to their pitchfork and their couple chickens, you know, I wanted to break those stereotypes. And so by what I think I'm able to do, because I bring just a little bit different perspective of being a single female rancher, you know, that owns an operation, that owns cattle, you know, that makes business decisions, you know, I mean, I make all the business decisions for our cow herd, you know, and being able to show this whole different side of the industry that I think people aren't aware that exists, but being able to explain it to in a way that it promotes the entire industry and maybe doesn't segregate, you know, any of the sectors of the industry. You know, I'm just as much for the cow-calf guy as I am for some of the packers, not all of the packers, but some of the packers, you know, but just being able to share those stories of how we were raised and the great things that the ranch has to offer and this lifestyle has to offer. But then in retrospect, be able to take those things that I've learned, you know, from being involved with some of those other entities and taking them back to other producers and sharing those stories with other producers too, and helping them develop their own stories that they can share, you know, not only with other producers and consumers, but even young people. And that's, I think if we're able to do that, you know, whether it be hosting interns or, you know, talking to college students or just showing that there is so many great things about being involved in agriculture and the beef industry, but, you know, you might have to find those niches and you might have to be able to push a certain agenda, but you can do it. And it's a great lifestyle and a living for sure.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely a lot you got that you said there that, you know, a lot of us take for granted that somebody else is doing it. But at the end of the day, I think we all need to, we can always do a little more to help out the cause, for lack of better words.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's not only important to help out the cause, but to also make sure that we don't tear other producers down.
Yeah.
You know, I see that time and time again, and we need to be so cautious of that. And I mean, there's times that I will, you know, go after a producer or something because I see something that they're doing that is just really portraying a bad image on the industry in a whole. And we need to be more cognizant of that. You know, we need to make sure that those bad apples out there, those people that are posting things on social media, I mean, that we don't need consumers seeing, you know, we need to make sure and actually stand up for our industry as a whole and those other producers out there and say, knock it off. You know, this isn't helping anything at all. And so quit it. You know, we can grow better together than we can apart.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of start winding down here, one of the things I want to ask you, and this is because I was just there 6 weeks ago. I saw that you were in Ireland, and it sounds like you're going back to Ireland. What can you tell us about the industry in Ireland?
Yeah, Ireland's neat. I was there a couple of times in 2002, I guess it was, would have been the last time I was there. And so originally how Ireland came about is I was on a trade mission with our governor and we went to the UK and we're doing some tours there in the UK and then jumped over to Ireland. I think the real reason, of course, was that Nebraska was playing football there. And so that was the reason that we included us as our stop. But I decided I was chair of international trade, which I still am at that time for NCBA. And so I decided I was going to reach out to the Irish Cattle and Sheep Association and see about staying a couple extra days and getting out on some of the farms there. And the executive director, Eddie Punch, kind of took me under his wing and showed me around those days. And by far, I mean, I loved the trade mission. The trade mission was phenomenal, but the tours afterwards and meeting those farmers was the icing on the cake for sure. And it was so neat because he would just cram as many farm tours and stops into a day as humanly possible. And so I don't know if you have been to Ireland, but the roads are horrible. I mean, they're single lane and they're windy and turny and I get motion sickness in a car. So we would hurry from farm to farm. And I remember there was one time myself and we had an ag reporter with us from the biggest ag paper. And she was in the backseat. We had to finally tell Eddie pull over because we had to take a couple of deep breaths alongside the road. But we would show up at these farms. And I mean, it was almost, this was how it would happen. I would walk in on the farm and there'd be me and Eddie and this reporter. And then there would be like 15 older gentlemen. They're all, you know, livestock producers. And they would just start hammering me with questions about, you know, BVD and growth promotants and antibiotic use. And I mean, and it was such a neat, neat experience. And Eddie and I look around because there was one farm I just got hammered right away about growth promotants. That was the very first question out. Because of course, you know, with Ireland being part of the EU, they don't allow for growth promotants. And so instead, what they've done to compensate is they've selected specifically for a lot of big, heavy muscle of animals. You know, I mean, they're using a lot of Belgian Blues and a lot of Linnies and you know, Piemontese and these double muscled animals that for the most part are having to come out of a zipper, you know, on a C-section. And so we're having this conversation and I was at the end of the day and I was exhausted and I might have said that, well, that's just pure BS, except I did not say the word BS. Everybody just got deadly silent and Eddie starts laughing and he's like, he continues to bring that up to this day that he's not going to be able to take me on another tour again because I might actually say what I'm thinking. But it was great, you know, got to meet so many neat producers, see a totally different style of raising cattle. I mean, the average herd site over there is less than 20 animals. They keep them in barns all winter, you know, and feed them in a barn all winter, which is a totally different concept than what I'm used to. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was so great to see producers and meet producers and hear their stories and their concerns. And we realized, you know, we have a lot of the same concerns and a lot of the same issues. And so now I laugh a lot because I get involved on the Irish cattle Twitter quite a bit, you know, and help ream. They're in a big battle right now with a lot of the environmentalists over there. And I continue to put my two cents in from a U.S. perspective on it, whether they want it or not. So it's been great.
Yeah, no, like I said, I was over there probably about 6 weeks ago and drove out of Dublin down to Kilkenny. And then across over to Limerick and had an opportunity to do a farm visit. It was totally different. They're running Angus, but predominantly, you know, everybody's got Belgian Blue, Charolais, and I think Limousine are the three main breeds over there. And you know, they're pushing that double muscling to get those carcass weights up and just totally, totally different type of environment. Like I said, on that West Coast, I think the cattle can only go out about maybe 2 or 3 months out of the year just because it's so wet over there on that Atlantic side. But it was definitely interesting going from that Atlantic side to, you know, I want to say probably 3 or 4 hours there. You went from quite a few different environments there from, you know, barley in the middle where they can actually raise hay and you know, dry that barley out and make straw to basically being raining every day. So it was definitely interesting. And the driving was, well, it took me 2 or 3 days to get the driving figured out. That was fortunately, when I was talking to my wife, she tells everybody that the first 2 or 3 days she was ready to come back. And then I was impressed that when we took the car back, that there was no scratches or dents. So we did really good.
You know what? You know what I always find is even the hardest thing is I did not drive in Ireland, but I used to go to New Zealand quite a bit. There for a couple of years, I was back and forth between here and there, and I got to drive quite a bit over in New Zealand and Australia. And I remember one of the trips I got back, and I'd been in like New Zealand for 2 weeks, and I was driving pretty much the whole time over there. And I flew into DIA, and it was a rough flight back. You know, it was one of those just I'd rather not have been on. And get into DIA and I get in my pickup and I'm leaving DIA and I get on this roundabout and I go around the roundabout the wrong way. And I'm like, oh no, you got to be pretty cautious of what you do when you get back to the U.S.
Yeah, no, I spent the entire time keep telling myself left and the amount of roundabouts and how narrow the roads are and no shoulders. Either you got a hedge or you got a stone fence right that you're right up against. But definitely worthwhile, and I would definitely looking forward to the next time we can go back over there, or maybe even over to Scotland. So,
oh yeah, I'm excited to get back over there for sure. And I think, you know, I think the important lesson about those countries, especially in the EU, is they're promoting such this anti-beef, anti-dairy agenda right now, and we need to make sure that we're supportive of everything the producers over there are doing. Just because they literally have this huge uphill battle that is a massive struggle. I mean, I saw it. I spoke at a forum in Brussels been a year ago last December, and it was just like they're pushing such a vegan vegetarian lifestyle that we need to make sure that we're able to back those producers too, because unfortunately, sooner or later, we'll see that same stuff here, and we've got to keep fighting those fights for all of us.
Yeah, no, I had the opportunity also. Fortunately, it was raining, so my wife wasn't too mad at me for doing it. But I went to a national shorthorn show and sale, and had opportunity to talk with several of the breeders over there. One of the things they talked about was similar to some things that are have gone on here, but there it was mandatory taking farm ground out, and I think they were putting into wetlands, and you know, stuff like that is stuff that they're affecting. And like you said, I think we need to support those, and as you know, an industry, we need to be aware of what's going on worldly. And you know, I don't know if you listen to Matt Perry, or he's got a podcast as well, and he had a individual from, I want to say UC Davis on there talking about the environment. And one of the things they talked about in Ireland was, the government's looking at getting rid of about 200,000 head of cattle over there, to combat, you know, greenhouse gases and stuff like that. So, you know, I think, we definitely need to, like you said, support them in any way we can.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. And I think that's what's so scary is so much of that is driven by emotion, and, you know, there's not scientific data to back it up. And when you start looking at the data, none of the things that people are saying makes sense. It literally does not make any sense or any ration or reason to it, except it's just emotionally driven. And as people that are coming forward with these personal agendas, and I feel for those producers, you know, that are having to battle that. I mean, yeah, we think we have it bad in the US because, you know, we have raising input costs and new coming regulations and blah, blah, blah. But at least we're not required to do mandatory TB testing every year. We're not required to not be able to lease ground because it's with outside of our area. And I mean, they have limitations on how many cattle you can run on an operation. And I mean, we're really fortunate that we don't have those, and we need to make sure that we keep it that way.
Yep. Definitely do. So, Jacqueline, as we kind of bring this to an end here, is there any thing else you'd like to share with the listeners about Flying Diamond Beef, Flying Diamond Ranch, or yourself?
I think we've covered a lot today.
Well, one of the things we didn't cover is ways to get a hold of you. Like I said, you got the website. I'll be sure to put the flyingdiamondbeef.com on there. But one of the things you do, I know – at least one, and maybe you got some other things you're doing, is you got a column in a ag journal.
Yeah. Yep. So I write for the Midwest Messenger family, which there's multiple papers that are involved in that, and Tri-State Neighbors. So that goes out to about 65,000 producers throughout the Midwest every week. I've done it now for over a decade, and every week that I write, I'm like, why am I still doing this? But the response has always been phenomenal. They give me editorial freedom to just write about whatever, which is really neat to see. So there's that option. Or, of course, all the social media aspects, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Yeah, just feel free to follow us or jump in on our journey. And Grace is my right hand on the beef business side. Her and her husband work for us here. And Salvetti's been a great addition on the ranch side, her husband. But Grace is determined we're going to start a YouTube channel this year. I'm still shaking my head at that one, but I guess we'll see if that one comes to fruition or not.
Well, you may need to see if you can get your personal assistant to help you with that, all your scheduling and events you got going on.
Well, yeah, thank God I've got Grace. She definitely fills in on a lot of those areas that I struggle at. So, and can keep the beef business running and stuff. And like I said, you know, none of this would be possible without a great team, and, you know, having Dad and then Grace and Salvetti on board we've been very, very blessed. And, you know, I'm hoping that team sticks together for many, many years, because the sky's the limit as far as I'm concerned.
Well, so like you got a lot going on. There's probably more things to come up, which you alluded to earlier for 2024. But Jacqueline, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to share a little bit about the ranch as well as the beef side.
Yep, absolutely. Glad to do it.